from PRI, Public Radio International. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Jim Fleming.
My tumor was the size, to quote my oncologist, of a grapefruit.
It was found by accident. I was having surgery, and that's when they found it.
I was 38 years old. I had children that were 3 and 1.
I'm a melanoma cancer patient. In less than 10 weeks from clear skin, I developed stage 3 melanoma.
The words, "you have cancer," are some of the most dreaded words we know. A little less than half of us have already heard them, or will someday. And once you do, your life will never be the same. Even if you live, even if your cancer goes into remission for the rest of your life, you will never again be a member of the village of the healthy. You will have crossed an invisible divide, and you'll take your place now in the village of the sick. What's life like there? In this hour, we'll meet some people who've made that passage and who found that, unbelievable as it seems, their lives are actually better, even with cancer. Katie Paul is a former nurse with a background in women's health. She looks like a mom or a teacher, maybe. An attractive woman, well-dressed, short hair, in her early 60s. She could be anyone. Her cancer was found in the course of some minor surgery.
Because it was such a shock. I mean, I woke up in the recovery room, and that's when I was told, and I still wasn't with it. And so I just thought, well, I must be in a dream. It's a nightmare. And it was interesting because I was very sick after surgery. And I think emotionally and physically, I did not want to open my eyes. I did not want to face it. And I think it is like a tornado, and your world is just turned upside down. I have children too, and the youngest was a teenager, 16, where you know he's looking at, the world is just opening up for him in terms of going on, graduating, and what to do. And all you really want for them is to continue to have that life and not have to, you know, worry about your mother, your father. I thought I was a pretty healthy person, thought I lived pretty well, knew things to do for my health. So when this diagnosis came, like, what? You know, why me? And then you find out, why not me? It happens, it can happen to anybody. It is very unsettling, off-putting to know that something was in your body that was, you know, doing this kind of damage. Meg came to visit me shortly after surgery, but she had this great analogy to the cancer cells. She said, you know, I don't want to think of doing battle with my body. I want to think of those cells as being immature adolescents, that they're going through this stage of rebellion and they're acting out. And they're just, you know, they're just not being good. And it's time just to grow up a little bit. Grow up and get out. And I love that analogy, especially since I've had a teenager at home. And so I thought, yeah, I like that. I don't want to be in battle with my body. I don't want to fight. You know, you read a lot of times after somebody's died, they said that, you know, the battle, they fought a courageous battle. And I don't want to feel that way. I don't want to feel it's a battle. I want to feel it's a dance. I want to feel that I'm trying to live with myself, my body, and have it respond. Another woman who I dearly, dearly loved, she had this great answer when people would ask her, what's your prognosis? They would actually say that, you know, what's your prognosis? And she said, it's the same as yours. I'm going to live until I die. You know, that's it. You're going to live until you die. So when you can frame it in that way, then you face things. And not that I don't think about dying. I mean, we all think about dying and what is that all about? But I'm not afraid. I'm not afraid of that anymore. And when you cannot be afraid, then I think you can just better live. I'm not afraid because I don't think there's anything horrible going to happen. What I would miss, of course, is my family, my friends here. But because I'm feeling that I'm engaging now, that I'm trying to be there now, that's what we have is what we get, you know, and hopefully we have a really long time for that, but who knows?
Katie Paul is living with recurrent ovarian cancer. With people like Katie Paul's lives at stake, how is what we used to call the war on cancer progressing? Well, the good news, and there is some, is that a whole new generation of therapies is on the way. So-called targeted therapies work by attacking the underlying molecular mechanisms of cancer. Immunotherapies stimulate the patient's own immune system to search out and destroy cancer cells. At the National Cancer Institute, where a lot of these new treatments are in clinical trial, researchers believe they are on the verge of transforming cancer into a kind of chronic condition, something you don't die from, but instead live with. Dr. Mark Clanton is a deputy director at the National Cancer Institute.
One of the hopeful messages that science is bringing us is the fact that as we understand more and more about how cells learn to grow when they're not supposed to, or live longer than they're supposed to, or move to parts of the body where they're not supposed to, as we know more about those processes, we can design very specific targeted therapies, that's the term, that act only on those switches or mechanisms that cause the cell to be abnormal in the first place. So the whole field of targeted drug therapy in cancer brings a great deal of hope.
Is it still true that once you see cancerous cells, you have to get rid of those cells? You can't simply treat the environment around them and prevent more from growing. You do have to treat the cells that have already gone bad.
In terms of our current state of practice, that's fundamentally true. However, that's changing very, very rapidly. For cancers that are in an early stage and haven't moved anywhere else, it may be possible to actually keep those cells in check. In some cases, there'll be therapies and methods to kill them. In other cases, there'll be therapies and methods that actually keep them under control and prevent them from moving to other places. That's another aspect of maybe converting some kinds of cancers into chronic controllable diseases, where in fact you don't necessarily eradicate the cancer, but put it under control so that in fact it doesn't disrupt the person's other normal activities and normal functions.
Is that the focus of most of the research now, or is there a focus on new technologies as well?
Oh, the focus spans both the precision in treating cancer, but also new technologies that will allow that to occur. Two really exciting areas are in the area of advanced imaging or molecular imaging, and the other area is in the use of nanotechnology and nanomedicine. And in the case of nanomedicine, we're using devices that are the size of 100,000 times smaller than the human hair to target cells, allow us to see those cells using imaging techniques. There are devices that are being investigated that use quantum dots that can be tuned to different colors and targeted to individual cells that will allow us to see tumors at the cell level. So these are not pie-in-the-sky type of technologies.
I understand that at NCI, the National Cancer Institute, you've established a goal of not eliminating cancer, which I gather you basically don't feel is possible at this stage even to think about, but to eliminate the suffering that goes along with it?
Well, actually, eliminate death and suffering due to cancer is our goal. It comes back to this idea that cancer really is a spectrum that begins at being susceptible to the disease but being healthy, moving on into the early stages of cellular change and transformation from normal cells to cancerous cells, and then into the development of tumors that move around. Our belief is that you can eliminate death and suffering by developing and advancing technology and therapy in each of these areas. You focus on treating the tumor better, but you also focus on preventing the advancement of cancerous cells. And also, there will be strategies that actually prevent the cancer in susceptible individuals at all. So if we can apply advancement in all of the developmental or evolutionary stages of going from a normal cell to a tumor actually that kills you, then applying therapies across the spectrum, it is reasonable to think that both suffering and death can be eliminated.
We've labeled cancer now as more a chronic disease than it was before. Does that change the way the patient's outlook develops, their ability to accept and withstand treatment?
Well, I think there are two diametrically opposed possibilities in terms of the way people might look at cancer as a controlled or controllable disease. On one hand, that could produce depression and concern about having to deal with this over the course of a lifetime. On the other hand, if you look at other diseases like diabetes and asthma, for example, where in fact we haven't really understood how to cure diabetes or asthma, and there are other examples like arthritis as well, but we know a lot about how to manage those diseases so they aren't disruptive, so that in fact they are controlled, and in fact we can live more normal lives. For some kinds of cancers that can't be prevented or modulated and controlled or cured, the hope is that in fact through technology and new treatments, some of them may be managed more like asthma, where people can have perfectly normal lives.
Mark Clanton is Deputy Director at the National Cancer Institute for the Office of Cancer Care Delivery Systems. When Meg Gaines was 38 years old and had two small children at home, she was diagnosed with terminal, inoperable ovarian cancer. Her doctor told her to go home and think about the quality, not the quantity, of her days. Instead, she grabbed him by the bow tie and said, "I don't think you understand. I intend to live." And that was in 1994. Today, Meg Gaines is cancer-free, and she spends her days helping other cancer patients stand up for their rights and their lives. Gaines is an attorney and the founder and director of the Center for Patient Partnerships at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. It's a nonprofit group that goes to bat for patients with life-threatening illnesses who are denied care by their insurance companies or their hospitals. Gaines told Ann Strainchamp she started doing this work after she recovered from cancer and found her heart just wasn't in her old job.
It wasn't so conscious, actually. When I went back to work, I went back to the same job, which was a great job, but it wasn't, I mean, it was working with prison inmates and law students, and it's a great job, but it's not what I felt drawn to. And what I realized, my oncologist would call me 2-3 times a month and say, "You know, I just operated on this woman and she's kind of down and depressed, and I'm wondering if you could just come talk to her for a little bit." And so, of course, I would go over to the hospital and walk into a room with hair and, you know, dressed and walking around and energetic. And the greatest gig I've ever had in my life is to be able to personify hope for people. I mean, there's just no words for it, how it feels to just be able to walk into somebody's room and say, by your presence, it's okay. You know, there's hope. You don't have to, you know, don't give up now. I mean, you may or may not live. It may or may not kill you. But don't give up now. It's way too soon. And so I'd start to do that. And then because I'm a lawyer and because I'm sort of, I think I've always been kind of advocacy. I think I was born sort of an advocate. People began to ask me for help about things. I can't get this. My insurance won't that. What about this? What about that? And I just realized that that's where my joy was, where I was getting joy, was in helping people with something that I knew how terrifying it was not to have help and not to have guidance.
So you've been doing this now, working as a patient advocate, working with the healthcare system for, what, 8-10 years? Are there one or two cases that stand out that really affected you really deeply, really taught you something?
Yeah, there's lots, several. One was a case with a woman who had uterine cancer that had gone undetected for a long time because even though she was bleeding and had symptoms, they kept saying, "Oh, you're just menopausal, you're just menopausal." She was a PhD student in English in her, you know, late 40s. She didn't have any money. She didn't, you know, she lived in an apartment and had a beater car. And anyway, to make a long story short, she was diagnosed with uterine cancer very late. She tried to get into a clinical trial. Her insurance, which was with a different carrier than her insurance company covered, they wouldn't let her go. They wouldn't refer her for care for the clinical trial. So we began this fight. And by the time we won the fight, sort of, by that time she had mets to her brain
and
was no longer eligible for the trial. And I remember sitting in her room in her apartment with her. There was a big group of people sort of helped take care of her. And she lived over off Park Street, and I could smell the Chinese food cooking and the lilacs blooming at the same time. I never forget that mix of smells. And watching her die and thinking, you consume care first and you worry about who's going to pay for it later. You do anything you can to scramble into treatment, but don't delay it, trying to figure out who's going to pay for it if there's any way to avoid a delay.
You said there were several cases that came to mind.
There's another case with a young boy, who's a three-year-old boy, who was diagnosed with a brain tumor. And his parents spent a short time because they didn't have a long time. So, you know, sort of the big rush always to find out what to do. So when they had decided what care they were going to have, the healthcare insurer decided that they wouldn't pay for that care. So, I remember distinctly talking to his father the night before Thanksgiving on Wednesday night. And he said, I don't know what to do. You know, we don't have a lot of money and, you know, they have another kid and we just don't know what to do. I can't, what if they don't pay for it? And am I going to be liable for all this? And I remember saying to him, you know, it's not an easy question to answer, but it's a simple question. And that is, what will you do right now for your son that will allow you to say, if the worst happens and he dies from this cancer, we did everything we could? Answer only that question. The rest of it takes care of itself.
You know, this whole system that we're talking about, people call it the cancer maze. But at a time when people are really sick and really vulnerable and really frightened, to have to negotiate two really difficult bureaucracies, the medical bureaucracy and the insurance bureaucracy, I don't see how anybody does it without an advocate like you.
I think the answer is people say, whatever my doctor says, that's what I do. And they just kind of turn off. I mean, you're at the worst time in your life. You're most terrified. You're most exhausted. And they're giving you medicine that just absolutely brings you near to the precipice. And you have 4, 5, 6 times as many problems as you've ever had in your life. And I don't know how people do it when they don't have help. I mean, I think the answer is a lot of people don't do a very good job of it.
And the people who've been successful at navigating this system and they've had good outcomes, what do you think are the personal characteristics that some of those people might have in common? What does it take to be a good cancer patient, but a successful cancer patient, whether you live or die?
Well, I think one of the advantages that I think some men have, and plenty of women do too, of course, but is the attitude, I guess, that you're entitled to good, competent, high-level, caring, comprehensible, timely care. And if you just exude personality that says, we all understand why we're here, it's kind of amazing how I think the system sort of folds around you.
Well, I would think the reverse, that kind of attitude would sort of annoy and irritate.
It's tricky. You can't act pissy. You know, you can't. You can't be rude or snooty. It's about confidence.
Upbeat, you're saying, positive.
Yes, I think, and strong in a certain sense, even when you don't feel strong. And I don't mean tough. I mean able to kind of be centered and see other people. And, I think...
Boy, that's a hard thing to call up when you're in a situation, because I think cancer especially, people must feel out of control. I mean, look, if I take a car into the mechanic, I know so little about cars that I can't second guess. If the mechanic says you need this $600 repair, I can't say, no, I don't. Mm-hmm.
And you're not even tired from the treatment.
So I'm not in control in that situation. Right. And you're talking about people who are not in control acting as though they are.
So how do you maximize it with the mechanic? How do you maximize it? What's your strategy? We all have a strategy for this, right?
Well, I'm maybe not a very good advocate. I tend to say, okay. But I'm going on whether this person feels like a good, honest, trustworthy person who looks me in the eyes or not. If they don't, then I'm not going back to that garage.
Mm-hmm. But you might actually have the car fixed right then, right?
Yeah.
Even though you're not going back to the garage? Yeah. Well, I think this is a great analogy, actually, although I hate the car analogy generally because
our bodies are not machines.
Right. Our bodies are not machines. We didn't design them. We didn't build them. And we don't know even close to that much about them. But I like the kind of powerlessness and the mechanic and how people handle it. And you make what you just described is you make a personal evaluation. You go with your gut, which is an integral part, I think, of evaluating any healthcare also. And then one thing that I do, both at the mechanic and at the, you know, surgeons or the doctors, is if I know I'm having to trust someone because I'm in, you know, stuck between a rock and a hard place and I don't have a choice about it at this point, I look at them and I say something like, well, I'm at your mercy because I really don't know anything about this and I'm going to have to trust you. So I hope you'll do right by me. And it's really, you know, if you have any chance to turn someone who is likely to deal with you less than honestly, if you have any chance to turn them around, I think it's because you say directly, I'm trusting you.
That's really interesting to me because the whole time we were talking, I kept thinking, how do you keep going and stay positive, you yourself, in the face of this healthcare mess? How do you get through the bitterness and the anger there must be at the bureaucracy, the people who are saying, you know, to these patients, no, you can't do this, no, you can't do that? And I guess it must be that trust, that basic faith you must have that when given the facts and looked directly in the eye, people generally will choose to do good.
I think probably several things. A little bit that I feel like when you get the right person at the right place at the right time, they'll do the right thing. I think that's often not true, doesn't pan out to be true, either because people don't want to or because they're not in a position to. They don't have decision-making authority at that level. If it's in our contract that we don't cover double transplants of any organ, and you know, this is one we're running into right now, and multiple myeloma, there's a clear study now out that says a double transplant is much more effective than a single transplant, right? So it's a classic case of insurance contracting not keeping up with medical technology. So I call this, you know, the patient advocate at the insurance company, and I say, hey, you should pay for this. And she said, this is an actual conversation. She said, well, we already spoke to them. Our contract only provides for one transplant per organ per lifetime. And I said, yeah, but that's back in the old days where we didn't have this information. You know, when you made this contract and we didn't have the information that, you know, double transplant is the standard of care. It's the way to go. And she said, right. She's a nurse, remember? She said, right, right. And I said, so what are you going to do about it? And she said, well, they should appeal. And I said, no, they should not appeal. And she said, you know, they should get an independent external review. So go up through this process that has its own set of problems. And I said, no, they should not do that. And she said, well, why not? And I said, because you should do the right thing. And there's just like long silence. I said, you know it's right, don't you? You've seen the study. And there's just kind of long silence. And she said, well, I don't know what you want me to do about it. And I said, I want you to go back to your boss and tell him you think it's the right thing to do and that this family should not have to fight this fight at independent external review. That's wrong. And she said, I'll get back to you. Well, you know, are they going to do the right thing? I don't know. We're covering our tracks. But in the meantime, I think just telling the truth to people and saying it, you know, in a sense, witnessing the truth and saying to a nurse who's on the other end of the phone, you know, this is the right thing to do and you're not doing it. It's very important. It's very important to stand there and say that. And I'm not the patient, so I'm not terrified and suffering. And so I can say, and I'm not her daughter, so I'm not afraid of alienating the doctor or the HMO or anything else. So I have the, you know, ritual permission to say a lot of stuff that if people disagree, I'm here to have the argument. But if you agree with me, you better do it.
Meg Gaines, I wish every cancer patient in this country had you. Thanks.
Yeah,
thanks for talking.
Sure.
Meg Gaines runs the Center for Patient Partnerships at the University of Wisconsin. Anne Strainchamp spoke with her. Later this hour, anthropologist Paul Stoller talks about how cancer led him deeper into the mysterious world of West African sorcery. I'm Jim Fleming. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from PRI, Public Radio International. It's to the best of our knowledge. I'm Jim Fleming. If cancer is going to become a chronic rather than an acute disease, how will that change the experience of having it, emotionally and psychologically? How will people with cancer cope with knowing that while they may live for many years, they may also never be cured? For a portrait of one such person, meet Pete Daly.
I'm a melanoma cancer patient and was first diagnosed a little over 2 years ago. And at that point, in less than 10 weeks from clear skin to an eraser-sized bump on my arm, I developed stage 3 melanoma. It's hard to describe kind of the brick wall you run into when you hear that diagnosis. I actually was riding my bike home after work, arrived to an empty house. It was dark and the phone's ringing, and I pick up the phone and my dermatologist is on the phone. And it also happened to be my birthday. So it was kind of like I was expecting a very upbeat day, and I get this call quite bluntly saying, "You have malignant melanoma." So it hit me like a brick wall. Mainly the main message I tell myself is today is today. I sort of clue in on how I'm feeling that day and judge my activities and outlook and view accordingly. Oftentimes I'm faced with activities like I want to do, like run the Ironman, and up until really the day of the event, I thought, well, maybe I won't be able to do this, but I figured I'd just take it literally one stroke at a time, one roll on my bike at a time, and one step on the marathon to do it. I think so often our mental construct of dealing with the disease is working through it. It's like a bad cold. I'll get over this. I think with something like cancer, you're dealing with the process of living, the process of dealing with the disease. So it brings you very much up to the present. And that's its real gift. And sometimes I think it's surprising having a cancer diagnosis that when you look around the world and see other people operating, that they don't get that message. They really don't get it. And although some people might feel sorry for me with a cancer diagnosis, more often than not, I feel sorry for others that they don't have that message, because their life would be fuller with that message. Could you ever envision not having this diagnosis? Or would you ever turn the time back? I probably wouldn't. The changes it's brought about in my life have been more important than just rewinding the clock.
Pete Daly is an engineer with recurrent melanoma. You know, it seems like such an unbelievable thing to say, that the benefits of having a terrible disease actually outweigh the costs. But you hear that, or that kind of thing, from a surprising number of cancer patients. Certainly enough to make you wonder. Rachel Naomi Remen is someone who spent a lot of time thinking about and witnessing the unexpected gifts of serious illness. She's a doctor, the co-founder of the Commonweal Cancer Help Program, and professor of family and community medicine at the University of California, San Francisco Medical School. She's best known as the author of Kitchen Table Wisdom and My Grandfather's Blessings, two best-selling collections of stories from her work counseling patients with chronic or terminal illness. When Rachel Remen sat down with Steve Paulson recently, she told him that cancer transforms people's lives, often for the better.
Cancer enables many of us to slow down and listen to ourselves for the first time and to discover who we are and what matters to us. And from that comes the ability to speak the truth to others, to have the courage to speak the truth to others, to even know what our own personal truth is. And so we can live closer to our own values, and we can live what we may perceive as a far better life than before we got ill.
It almost sounds like you're saying that if there's something within us, maybe within our personality, that has kind of given us trouble, but we've managed to bury it before, if we do get cancer, we have to confront that.
Well, let me give you an example in the form of a story. One of my patients, a wonderful woman, her husband referred to her as crazy clean. She was a woman whose house was in total order. Every drawer was perfectly organized. You know, every piece of metal shone. One of her daughters actually said to me, "My mom can spot a Cheerio on the floor of the kitchen from the other room." But of course, cancer changed that for her, Steve. She became so weak that she could barely get from her bed to the bathroom from her chemotherapy, you know. And the entire neighborhood came in and invaded her perfectly organized kitchen and cooked meals for her family. Kind hands, you know, unaware of the household rules, washed and folded and put away laundry in all the wrong places. At one point, her husband even brought a kitten who shed everywhere. But the kitten comforted her during the night when her chemotherapy made her so sick that she couldn't sleep. And afterwards, she told me such a wonderful thing. She said she had visited with her sister, and she was sitting in the kitchen drinking tea with her sister and looked out in the living room, and her sister had one of these rugs that shows every footprint. It had been vacuumed so perfectly that every hair of the rug was pointing in the same direction. And she said, "Rachel, at one point, this would have given me a deep sense of satisfaction. Now it just looked lonely and untouched by life," right? And she says, "You know, I wouldn't want to be the way I was before I had cancer. I drove people crazy. I resented my family because they disturbed the order of things." She says, "You know, there's so much more important in life than a perfectly clean kitchen floor, Rachel." My experience of sitting with people, you know, I'm a therapist to people with cancer. I've sat and listened to people, listened to their stories, shared their experiences. My sense is watching people play their hands, you know, in the presence of death, very rarely is the important thing power or perfection or possessions. Mostly, the top card in life is love.
Do you also find some people who just say, "To hell with the lessons of cancer. I managed to get over it. I managed to conquer it. And thank God it's done with, and I don't want to have to deal with it anymore."
I think that there are certainly many people like this. There are many people who say, "I want to put this behind me and get on with my life." But I have also seen that sooner or later, another challenge will come up, and they will discover what they have learned from the challenge of cancer but haven't been willing to look at.
What have you learned about how doctors approach cancer? And are there things to learn from a doctor's perspective?
Well, obviously, we are trained to cure cancer. We're the original. Let's put it behind them and let them get on with the rest of their lives. People. And I think everyone hopes for that. It would be wonderful to eradicate cancer from the face of the earth. I dream of that day. But until that day happens, cure may not be a sufficient strategy for dealing with a human being who has cancer. I think what happens for many people is that they accept from their doctors what their doctors can give them, the treatments, the radiation, the surgery, the chemotherapy, and then they go and they search for healing elsewhere, outside of the medical system.
But I'm wondering if also some doctors are realizing that what they have to do is more than just do surgery in the right way, that there is this whole other emotional side of it.
Well, you know, my field is integrative medicine. I teach a course at UCSF School of Medicine called The Healer's Art, and it's now taught in 33 medical schools across the country. And the course basically reminds students that they need to address not only the bodies of their patients, but to recognize and strengthen the spirit of their patients, the soul of their patients, the emotional life of their patients. It's not just about taking care of the disease. The person is much greater than their disease.
Now, I've heard that you also run workshops for doctors on detoxifying death.
Well, we enable doctors to explore death not as failure, which is the way most people have been trained to see it, but as mystery. It's the unknown. One of the things we do is we get doctors telling stories. Let me tell you a story of mystery from my own professional life so you get a sense of what it might be about. One of my patients came to me at the end of his life, and he had an agenda. He's a beautiful man, an architect, and his agenda was that he wanted to invite one of his friends or family members to each one of our sessions because he knew he was dying of this cancer. And he wanted to thank them for everything that they had brought into his life, one at a time. And halfway through one of the sessions, he turned to me and he said, "Rachel, I'm an educated man. I must believe death is the end. And you're an educated woman. You believe death is the end too, don't you?" And I said, "Well, I used to think that, but now I don't know. I just don't know. I think death is the mystery that is present in the heart of life." And he said, "You don't think that there's a heaven with little angels up there, do you?" And I said, "You know, I don't know. We are in the presence of mystery." And he looked at me, and then he changed the subject. And then, in every session afterwards, he would raise this. And towards the end of our meetings together, he was becoming sicker and sicker, he raised it again, and when I said, "I don't know," he began to laugh, and he said, "I don't know about this, I don't know. Rachel, I have to believe that death is the end. I have to believe this. I'm an educated man. But just in case it isn't, I will come back and show myself to you in some way just to let you know I've lost this argument." And we both began to laugh, and he said, "I'll come back as a great white bird, and I'll show myself to you." And I said to him, he was a Japanese man, I said, "You know, this is out of character for you to drop in as a great white bird. I mean," and then he began to laugh, and he said, "I'm much more of a minimalist. I won't do it that way. I'll find my own way to show you if I can." And then we changed the topic, and we talked about something else. About a month later, this man died. And a few weeks after this, I'm standing in the Transamerica building, the big pyramid in San Francisco, waiting for the elevator. I began thinking about this man, how much I miss him, and what a remarkable human being he was, and what a privilege it was to know him. And the elevator arrives, it's empty, and I get in, and it starts up very abruptly. And I look down to get my feet under me, and there, lying on the floor of this elevator, is one great, big, perfect white feather. Hmm. Now, this is mystery. The feathers that fall into all of our lives, because mystery surrounds us, the feathers that fall into all of our lives don't prove anything. What they basically are an invitation to stay awake and pay attention, because the mystery at the heart of life may speak to you at any time. And that sense of mystery is what people who are physicians often don't share with one another, but we have all experienced it. We've all experienced people who get well for no reason that we can think of, people who don't get well for no reason we can think of. We've seen people who, at the end of their lives, have conversations with what appears to be another world. Who knows what all this is? But there's so much more to life than the way we live it most of the time, and I think often cancer is an invitation to participate in that larger life.
That's wonderful. Is death something that you no longer fear, if you ever did fear it?
Oh, I think surely I fear death. I think everyone fears the unknown to some degree. But, you know, fear is an interesting experience. It's a high-energy state. It's very close to excitement and curiosity as you feel it inside. I have become, over the years, much more curious than fearful. And I have a sense that we are not the highest authority in this world, that this world is unfolding according to a larger plan, and that plan is love.
Rachel Naomi Remen talking with Steve Paulson. Remen is the co-founder of the Commonweal Cancer Help Program in Northern California. She's the author of Kitchen Table Wisdom and My Grandfather's Blessings. Next, lessons in living with cancer from a West African sorcerer. I'm Jim Fleming. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from PRI, Public Radio International.
National support for To the Best of Our Knowledge is provided by Powell's Books, an independent bookseller since 1971, presenting powellsbooks.blog, a window to the world of literature, authors, and up-to-date book news on the web at powells.com.
It's To the Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Jim Fleming.
My tumor was the size, to quote my oncologist, of a grapefruit, even though I couldn't feel it. And so it was serious, and I needed to attend to it right away.
Paul Stoller had enjoyed 50 years of good health when he was diagnosed with lymphoma. He had some idea of what to expect, the chemotherapy, the radiation, and so on. What he didn't expect was to be plunged back into the mysterious world of West African sorcery. But that's what happened. Stoller's an anthropologist. As a young man, he did his first field work with the Songhai tribe in Niger, where he was apprenticed to a sorcerer. It was a strange and frightening world, and Stoller thought he'd left it behind 25 years ago. But he told Steve Paulson that in confronting cancer, he finally began to understand the lessons his teacher had tried to give him long ago.
My teacher's name was Adamu Jenitongo. He was born in 1882. He died in 1988, so he lived to be quite old. And he took me on as his apprentice, and I studied with him over a period of 17 years.
What were some of the most memorable things you learned from him?
Well, he taught me really two stages. The first stage, he taught me lots of incantations. He taught me how to identify plants used in healing for physiological illnesses, but also for what he would call bush illnesses, which are illnesses generated through spirits. The second stage, he didn't really teach me directly. He sort of laid the seeds during the first years of my apprenticeship for me to understand the second stage, which you have to reach on your own, walking your own path, as he would say.
What were some of those things that you finally realized?
Well, some of the things were that, you know, at first I thought sorcery was a kind of great competition, and I liken sorcery to gunfighters in the Old West, where you compete with other people to be the best, the most powerful, and it's sort of an amoral pursuit where it doesn't really matter what you do to them as long as you succeed and you become the most powerful person. When I was diagnosed with cancer, I realized that sorcery is much more profound than that. It is really a way to carry yourself in the world, a way to carry yourself with dignity and strength in the world to face whatever problem or whatever difficulty you may have to face.
Well, you tell some remarkable stories about your experiences back in Africa, and I can understand why you came to that feeling that sorcery was a kind of competition. I mean, you tell a story, for instance, about how you were visiting another sorcerer, and she basically paralyzed you.
That's right. What happened was that I was sent to study with this one particular woman, and she did not receive me very well, which was really unusual because the Songhai tend to be very hospitable people. And then when I went to sleep, and this was in a town called Wanzorbe, which is the great village of sorcerers among the Songhai people in West Africa. And when I went to sleep, I woke up in the middle of the night with a fright, and I sensed a presence in my room. And then when I touched my legs, I couldn't feel them. And then my teacher had told me that in moments of danger like this, you recite an incantation called the Genji Hao, which means to harmonize the bush. And so I recited this incantation over a long period of time, and gradually I began to get feeling in my legs. So I was partially and temporarily paralyzed. The next morning, I realized that I had to confront the woman, and I did.
That must have been terrifying, though. I mean, it sounds like she was trying to kill you.
Well, she was testing me, and one of the possibilities was that I could die from the test. I mean, sorcery is not really a game. It's not anything very romantic. So I confronted her to attempt to demonstrate my courage to her, and then she came up and smiled at me, and she welcomed me into her house, and she said, "I can see now that you're a man with a pure heart. It is now time to begin to learn."
Well, there's one other episode that you talk about in your time back in Africa, and that's, it sounds in some ways even more terrifying than the night that you were paralyzed. Apparently, there were bad things in the air, and there was evil energy that was directed at you, perhaps, and a couple of people actually died. And what happened then?
That was also in Wanzorbe, you know, about 20 years ago. There is a kind of sorcery among the Songhai called death sorcery. If you are unprotected from it, and if you in this sort of world, it will penetrate you and you may die from it. Now, in my case, I had protection. I mean, I had eaten certain things and I wore certain rings that protected me from it. So I felt it. I felt myself getting weaker and weaker and weaker. So I recited this Genji Hao, this incantation that harmonizes the forces of the bush to protect you from people that would try to harm you. And so my reasoning was that by doing that, the death magic was deflected to other people. And so during that evening, an old man, one of my hosts, died, and a 2-year-old child died. So at that point, I realized it was maybe time to leave, you know. So I left there, and I've not been back.
Now, you've talked about this series of incantations, this process called mm-hmm. Genji Hao. Mm-hmm. Did that come into play at all when you were trying to deal with your own cancer?
Yes. For a long time, as I mentioned, after I left Niger around 1990, the aspect of sorcery in my life sort of drifted to the background. But when my oncologist was telling me what I was going to go through in my treatments, he was describing to me 5-hour treatment sessions in which I would get chemotherapy drugs and I would get immunotherapy drugs. And I realized what I had to do and that I had to sort of bring what I had learned forward in order to cope with these treatments and the notion of cancer in my life. So he left to do some calculations about how much of this stuff he was going to put into my body. He came back and my brother was with me. I said, "Take my hand." I said, "You have your way of dealing with cancer and healing. My teacher taught me this, and you know, I ask you to respect it," which he did. And I recited the Genji Hao.
So you were doing this with your oncologist, right?
Right, there. In the examination room. Right, in the examination room. So we did that, and I said, "Excuse me, but I have to spit." I had to spit in the 4 directions of the oncology room. So he was cool with that, you know. He was cool with that. He said, "I'd like to learn more about this." So to his credit, you know, that was an indication that I wanted to continue to be under his care. So he takes me out to the infusion room and introduces me to my oncology nurse. And she was this extremely attractive woman. And I said, "God, if anyone's going to drip poison into my body, let it be this woman." So indeed it was. And she said, "Hi, Paul. Jennifer, I'm going to take very good care of you." So I turned to my oncologist and I said, "You see, the magic is beginning to work already."
Now, do you think that your approach to having cancer was any different than most Americans because of your background with sorcery?
Yes. In sorcery, illness is not your friend, but illness is your companion. It's always present. And therefore, if you recognize that illness is your companion and you treat it with respect, then you master it in a sense that you use it to make yourself stronger.
Is sorcery still a part of your life today?
Well, you know, my teachers, when they took me on 25 years ago, they made me promise to pay homage. And so I have a little altar in my home, and I recite incantations, and I do things for other people. So, for example, when I was in the infusion room of the cancer center, I told them that I'd be doing things and just get used to it. And the nurses were very cool about it. So I would, you know, recite the Genji Hao, and I'd recite another incantation of protection for me, but also for everyone else there. I mean, it's not just for me. It was for the whole room to be sort of harmonized. And the Songhai believe that if there is to be inner harmony, there has to be a corresponding outer harmony. And in the absence of outer harmony, inner harmony cannot be achieved. So whenever you're going through any kind of healing, you have to sort of set the harmony of the outside world and set that in motion with the harmony of the inside world, you know, inside your body.
So what do you feel after that incantation?
Well, I feel a sense of peace, you know. Every time I recite it, it reconnects me to my teacher and his lineage of healers going back to the 18th century. And so it gives me a sense of peace, but also a sense of continuity, and also a sense that I'm doing a small thing to maybe make the world a little bit better than it is.
Paul Stoller teaches anthropology at Westchester University of Pennsylvania. He describes what African sorcery taught him about cancer in his book, Stranger in the Village of the Sick. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Jim Fleming. For more information about anything you've heard in this hour, or to order tapes or CDs, visit our website at www.ttbook.org. You've been listening to Living with Cancer, number 320A.
PRI, Public Radio International.